Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Today's guest on Dirty Water brought a brutal but beautiful savagery to professional surfing. His favourite tee featured a skull and the slogan, "Kill them all, gobble sort them out." And he was the star of the Quicksilver ad, "If you can't rock and roll, don't fucking come." He's a three-time runner-up to the world title, two of them in excruciatingly controversial circumstances, although he evened the ledger a little later in his career by winning three Masters World titles. He was the King of Sunset, a pipeline master, and had the extraordinary ability to gain 15 pounds for added ballast during the Hawaiian season and then shred 30 prior to hitting the small wave events. But as my old friend Rob Bain told me recently, as legend fades and real life starts to stare back at you, it's a challenge to navigate the autumn years in peaceful contentment. Our guest, Gary Kong.
Kong. Kong. Gary Kong.
Hello, mate. How are you?
Good, guys. How you doing?
Pretty good.
All right.
Not bad, actually. Well, you know, a few health issues, but that's all right.
Hey, so I thought, first of all, let's just do a bit of background, like where you're living now, what you're doing, and maybe talk about your little hip thing.
Yeah, well, I'm living on the Sunshine Coast in Moolloobar. And I injured myself at a workplace thing about 5 months ago, and then that led to, I found out that I need a hip replacement.
So what was the injury and what were you doing?
What happened was about a year and a half ago, I had to have a good look at myself. I blew out to about 146 kilos. Wasn't surfing. I was just in a bad spot, you know. I just, dad was sick, just on his deathbed kind of thing, and kind of last of the bloodline upwards. And I remember I had to do this photo for North Shore Board Riders, and I saw the photo and I was like, are you kidding me? I'm about to die. So what I did is I went and I studied intermittent fasting, and I went and got a job as a delivery driver, delivering to restaurants. So, you know, delivering like 20-litre drums of oil and bags of rice and all sorts of different things, from crackers to everything, right?
Yeah.
And that was like a 6 in the morning till 2 in the afternoon. And I did that for a year and a half with intermittent fasting and lost about 42 kilos. But in doing that, what's happened is that I've... the hip has already been gone. I didn't know about it, but I jumped out of the side of the, like, got out of the side of the truck, didn't jump, I got out of the side of the truck, and I did something to my left knee. It's the knee I injured at Sunset when I got all the stitches into that year, by that flying board, and I had nothing going on in the hip, and then about 3 weeks later, I started getting all this pain in the hip, and it just really started getting bad, and about 2 months ago now, I got the MRI and x-rays done, and that's like the hip, the left hip is perfect, but the right hip looks like it looks deformed. It looks like it's just so deformed, and it looks like the bone, it's just bone on bone, and it's pretty bad. So at the moment, I can hardly walk on crutches. Yeah, not good.
And you're saying that your buddies have come together and raise some money for the operation, huh?
Oh, listen, I had some friends that have helped me out because in Australia. Work, like, you know, this kind of happened at work, really. Well, work cover don't cover it. If you're not private and you go public, you got to wait nearly 2 or 3 years to get it done. You can go private. You got to pay for a year private, $400 something a month, and then you still got to pay $3,000 on top of that to get it done, but wait a year. And I was just in a situation that, I was, you know, financially, I had my hands tied, and I just was getting, I can't even tie my shoelaces up, can't even get to my feet, really, can't even touch my toes. Excruciating pain 24/7. It's been like that for about 2 months now. Morphine and all the drugs they've given me don't even work. So it's been a little interesting couple of months, mate.
Yeah, right. So the morphine doesn't work because it's nerve pain, huh?
I don't know. I think it's probably nerve, but by the look of the x-rays, just the way the bone has, like, what happens is that when it gets that bad bone on bone, it just kind of, it actually tries to bind together at a point, you know?
Yeah.
It actually tries to grow, the bone in the hip tries to grow around the ball socket to stop it from moving, just for protection.
Yeah.
So, and the funny thing about it is it's been like that for a long time. Like, you know, my specialist in that reckons it's been going on for about 15 years. And I've never really, I have felt it. I don't have felt it in my surfing. I felt 10 years ago, I started really having trouble getting my back foot in the right position. But I had no pain with it. I could never work it out. But I know what it was now. And so, yeah, on the 14th, in 2 weeks, I have the operation, thank God. Yeah.
Wow. So how much does the operation cost? Like $30,000 or so?
It's about $30,000.
Yeah,
in Australia, you know, and I just feel for some people that don't, you know. I'm just lucky to have some good mates and to help out, because I can't imagine sitting around for 2 years like this. I don't know. You couldn't do it.
You'd go to some pretty dark places, huh?
Sorry?
You'd probably go to some pretty dark places.
Yeah, listen, it's been hard already, you know. But, you know, I've got a lot of good people around me, so that's important.
Are you married or anything now?
No, not married. No. Not married. Single.
Yeah. And, single and looking, mate?
Sorry?
Single and looking?
Very happy, mate. I've got a lot of friends around. But those days are over, mate.
Hey, it's funny you're talking about the, you know, your wild weight fluctuations, because I was reading an interview just before on, you know, Warshaw's Encyclopedia of Surfing, and Reggae wrote it, John Ellis. It was from when you were 32, and you spoke about how before you went to Hawaii, you had put on a stone, so you'd be a bit more ballast in the water, and then you'd drop from 16, and you could drop from 16 stone to 11 and a half stone. So from, you know, I guess, what's that, you know, like 250 pounds to about 180.
Yeah, I was very fortunate with my body that I could do that. And, you know, in saying that, with having the type of circuit we were on back then, it was brutal, because we had Hawaii and then we had to surf in minute waves. So I was quite lucky I could fluctuate my weight really quickly like that, which in the end is not a good thing. I wish I knew about intermittent fasting back then. It's really, intermittent fasting has been a big saviour in my life. Like, if I didn't do that a year and a half ago, I would be dead. The doctor said you would be dead by now. You would have had a massive heart attack.
Jesus. So how do you operate with intermittent fasting? Or what's your program?
Well, the program is that you actually start... you start off on a thing called, it's a time thing when you eat, right? So basically I started off on Warrior, which you're allowed to eat between 12 and 6. And you have to stop eating at 6, because most people's body takes 12 hours to eat all the sugar out of it. So, you know, if you stop eating at 6 and you arrive at 7 in the morning, your body actually has a click inside it that just switches to keto, the famous keto word that everyone tries to do through eating and all this other crap and training, which it does work, but it's a lot harder to stay in the keto state. So when you stay in the keto state, you're actually, the body's eating fat. And if you do any type of exercise within that, it's just really burning the fat. You know, and why a lot of people give up on that is that they don't see any visual results, because it takes about 3 months of doing that to 4 months, because it starts eating all the fat around your organs first, so you see nothing on your face or around your gut or anywhere.
Yeah.
And then after 4 months, I switched to OMAD, which is pretty gnarly. You can only eat between 4 and 6.
Jesus.
And I kind of eat what I want, you know, and have a few beers, but I only do it in between those hours, and it's just been a remarkable result. You know, the photo I've got from when I started to now is like two different people. Like, it's just ridiculous. It's crazy. And the second thing I realized is that the energy levels that you have when your body is in the keto state, like when it's burning fat, your energy is so much more, how do you say, it's just a stronger energy.
Like a more focused energy.
Yeah, you just focus and it's just more. So, yeah, it's been a game changer for me. And I think, you know, I had to go through that to to get my hip fixed.
Yeah.
So... And thank God that's happened now and not when I was 140-something kilos, you know. So 14 days down, I'm really pretty hard on myself right now coming up to the op and to just, you know, intensifying the muscles around my back leg.
Yeah.
My right leg, the power leg. And, yeah, just getting ready for the op.
Jesus, man. So how many kilos have you lost?
I think I've lost like 42 kilos.
Wow, so that's about, for the Americans, it's probably about 80 pounds, huh?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's ridiculous.
It's insane, man.
Yeah, it is. And you know what? Anyone can do it. It's just, you've just got to be mentally strong on where you want to go with it. You know, I've got a daughter that's 17 years old now, and, you know, I want to see her get to 21.
Yeah.
So I had a few motivations and my surfing. You know, my surfing just deteriorated completely, you know, and I just wasn't enjoying surfing at all, you know, so this is a game changer for me, and it's a second lease on life. Most people that have spoken to that have had it done, which is, you know, there's a lot of surfers, one in particular, Glenn Casey's been giving me some good info. He's had a double hip replacement, and it's just changed his life. You know, his surfing's just like, he's just loving it now. And they're pretty good at it. You know, they get you up and walking around pretty quickly, but you've got to do the right rehab and re-education for all that stuff. So, yeah, I'm looking at getting back in the water right now, the 1st of January.
Okay.
I'm going to give it the right time, you know, the 5, 6 months, 7 months, whatever it takes to get it, you know, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going to be, it's going to be a wild change in your life.
Yeah, you know, and it is a big change in my life, because I've had to, you know, just change a few things that I do, you know, a lot of things I do in my life, you know. I've just sort of lived for granted, and I've never really had any big operations before or major injuries except an appendix. So, at 50, going on 58 soon, it's been a pretty good run.
Yeah, and just the ability to live pain-free will be transformative.
Oh, that is the biggest thing I'm looking forward to. I mean, I can't even explain, like, there's just, you know, I'm sitting right now, I've got this one position I can sit, and it's just like, don't move, man. Whatever you do, just stay right there. So, you know, I'm quite lucky. I've got a good friend taking care of me, you know, which you need help with these things. You can't do it on your own. So, yeah, that's where I'm at right now. I'm just looking forward to getting repaired and getting back in the water, yeah.
So I spoke to about your old friend Rob Bain before I called you, and he suggested we talk about the navigation of life as the legend fades away and real life starts to stare back at you.
Mm.
So how's it been for you? I mean, I think you retired in 96 or 97, and but then you did the three Masters events, you won them all. So I guess around probably 2010, it probably started to fade a bit, the whole surf, pro surf thing. Would that be correct?
Yeah, I forget when the Masters were. The full pro thing, yeah, I think 2010, 2013. I'm not sure. Around then. I can't remember, man, that far. But, yeah, you know, and then the Masters come along and I got to redeem myself there, which is great. And that's when I kind of, you know, I did the Masters the other year in the Azores, but I wasn't really prepared for that. It was just a reunion thing for me to meet up with old mates, and I had no expectations of winning the Masters, especially after winning it three times in a row. That's already been done, sort of thing. But that event is just an amazing event to connect with people.
Yeah. What was it like, you know, when you know, because yeah, you left the tour and the big pro tour in 96, 97. What was it like stepping away and having just to be a, you know, regular civilian like all of us?
Look, I was quite fortunate when the kind of all happened that I had, my daughter was born, and I had a different responsibility, and I'd moved back to Australia. I was living at Ocean Shores at that time, and I had about three, my partner at that time had a business, so there was money there, and I was doing little surf coaching things on the side, and I was kind of lost, you know. And I took my daughter to a swimming lesson, well, a couple of times, a spot out the back of Mullumbimby, and I just didn't agree with me the way they were teaching kids to swim. So I built an massive indoor kids swimming centre called Kong for Kids, which I had for about 12 years. It did really well, doing about 200 kids a week. I was the main teacher there, teaching kids to swim. It was really, really cool.
And what happened to the swim school?
Well, I wasn't married, but I separated from my Brazilian partner there. That's the mother of Luna, my daughter. And I went to the Gold Coast and did some work at Mount Wuchi for a little bit. And then I moved up to the Sunshine Coast, and I sort of sloughed around and blew out 240-something kilos. And, yeah, and just sort of got my life back on track now. But it's been an interesting run. Listen, when you actually leave the tour, and it took me a little while to get it just because I had my daughter, but I guess for a lot of people it's really, really hard. It's a really hard thing when you see the train leave the station, you know, and you've got to actually go and do and find something else. And again, I've been very fortunate. Some people haven't in my generation because we didn't make much money, you know, really. My properties that I owned, I lost in France to my first wife. So, and I still don't own a property. So I just basically, I just live my life the way I'm living it right now, you know, like day by day and just enjoying it. Like I said, I've got a beautiful, healthy daughter and my life's back on track and yeah.
It was interesting that move to France. I think you were maybe 22, 23. And then that marked that big shift for you, you know, obviously from Kong to the, you know, to the very serious professional, and also from tough kind of, you know, son of a fisherman to this kind of urbane sophisticate. What do you? And you learned French too, didn't you? Because you lived there for 10 years.
Yeah, I actually still speak fluent French better than a lot of mates who still live there, like Reed Pinder.
Yeah, or Fipsy.
And he thinks he can speak French, but he can't. But his coffee's all right, but that's about it. I love the guy. I moved there really like early 80s, kind of. Like there was only Belly and Morris Cole there at the time. That was a big change in my life as well, you know, and meeting Pascal and, I have to say, like, you know, the pinnacle of my kind of surfing, I really feel, was, you know, from 85 to 90, you know, those 5 years there, a bit further on, but really, you know, all those events that I won in Pipe and the Triple Crowns and all that stuff as while I was living in France. So I had a really good focus on it, you know. For 27 years I was in France. So, nearly more than half my life.
Well, I didn't realise you were there for so long.
Yeah, 27 years I was there. The whole changing of the guard there, you know, from I think Rip Curl had kind of just really started the year before, and there was no hint of Quicksilver or Billabong. It was a classic time. I was actually, you know, very lucky to see a lot of things in my life, but that was one of them. Seeing France in those early days with Grabier with no one out really. There was me, Morris, and Belly, and a handful of French guys that wanted to have a go at it. And years before jet skis and years before social media, it was great.
My God, it must have been unbelievable. Where was your? Because I know you started off in Lacanau, but you had a place in Hossegor later on, didn't you?
Yeah, I lived in Lacanau for about 10 years. That was great, and I always, you know, went south when the swell got bigger, and I knew it was on to Hossegor. So I had the best of both worlds. Because living in the Medoc, there's a lot of good waves up there when the swell direction's right. It's not too big. And obviously you live in the Medoc, so you've got all the best wine in the world, which I acquired a very great taste for after a while. Plus, you know, and their food and their culture and everything about the French way of life. I just really love that way of life, you know. And it's dramatically changed now, like the rest of the planet, you know.
Yeah, it's so different. I think Morris is telling me he counted, I think, 1,300 people getting surf lessons on that stretch from, you know, Lenore upwards.
Yeah, surfing's just gone absolutely crazy. I mean, you know, we've seen it in Australia as well. But, yeah, so 27 years in France, and then moving back to Australia was real interesting. It felt like moving, you live in a box in Australia. You're not allowed to do anything. I call it the land of no.
What do you call it?
The land of no.
Oh, the land of no.
You know, you want to take ham off the sandwich or the thing. No, I can't do that. You know, you've got to do this, you've got to do that. There's traffic signs, there's this, there's that. There's all these rules and regulations. It's like, I just again feel so blessed to have, you know, remembering the real start of it just after, you know, 77, 78, when I really got into surfing and it was just phenomenal. You know, it was just phenomenal times. Lucky to see it. And the growth of professional surfing, you know, that was just phenomenal to see that through the 80s, you know.
Yeah, and then you were there when Kelly, I mean, it's incredible Kelly's still on the tour, but you were there in 92 when Kelly arrived, huh?
Yep, I was there when Kelly, who arrived, sorry, did you say then?
Slater.
Oh, Slater, yep. And Tommy Curran, arrived as well, living there. I don't think Slater never lived there. But.
Oh, no, I meant on the tour. I meant you were there I didn't mean to deviate from France, but I just meant on the tour when you were there in 92 when Slater came along and shook things up.
Yeah, he got a lot of things given to him. I have to say that.
You didn't think I was giving that a better touch at all.
Oh, really?
I don't know. If it, no one really spoke about that. There was a final there. It was the final of the semi. I don't remember. But it was 10-foot. Canoe.
Yeah.
And somewhere there around there, it was big. It was massive. And it was really hard to get out. Anyway, I paddled out early and I picked the window and I got out and I'm trying to stay in a position and they're calling Kelly and Kelly wasn't showing up. Anyway, supposed to start the heat. Anyway, they called the semi to the final. I'm sure it was the final. Semi. Anyway, they called it off so Kelly could get out the back. And I was like, what the fuck? I was like, I'm already out the back. I've been sitting out here nearly 20 minutes.
Yeah.
And he shows up late or wherever he was and he couldn't get out. It took him 3 times to get out. So they waited for him to get out the back and they started it. And I was like, I come in, I was like, well, you know. Anyway.
You would have been a little bit more verbose than that, wouldn't you?
A little bit what?
More verbose. Wouldn't have just gone, well.
No, I had, you know, I always spoke my truth to the ASP and the judges, what I thought. Probably why I lost 3 world titles by the skin of my teeth.
Yeah, so you say that you lost 2 by the incompetence of the system, specifically those 4-man heats, which leads into that, in 93 at Pipe when Des Ho blocked for Larry Rios, so he couldn't get into the final. And if you got into the final, you would have won, and then Derek wins the world title.
Yeah, the one before that was even harder with Damien, even though there's no love, Damien, but that was the year they decided they're going to finish the world tour.
In Manly.
In Manly, and I left Hawaii in number 1 position. It's the year I won the events back-to-back. Should have been world champion, you know. I shouldn't have had to go on to Manly to compete in my new ways at Manly. And the funny thing about that is that the priority rule at that stage was that if you had priority, no matter where you were, the guy who had priority caught the wave. Even if he couldn't get around that section, you could not catch that wave. So I was paddling back out. I needed like 3-point-something and this right calm, and Damien was way deeper. And he took the wave and just went straight in the white water. And I couldn't catch it because I would have been called interference and I would have gotten 3.5 and I would have won the world title that right there. But then they changed the rule 2 weeks later. If the surfer can't get to where the other surfer is, the other surfer can catch the wave. I was like, the fuck? You know, like, but, you know, that world title, my first one, should have been won in Hawaii.
Yeah.
You know, and the other one, the hose, yeah, that was a hard one to take, you know. Well, I think there was Curran and then Derek, right? Curran come back from retirement for my second one.
Yeah.
And there was a couple of weird calls in that one as well. And then, yeah, the third one was the gut wrencher, you know. So, but, you know, listen, I know what should kind of happen in my heart, but listen, I had an amazing career, pretty stoked. I wouldn't change anything I'd change those rules, but I wouldn't change anything else.
You know, how does someone like you, you know, who's ridden those highest of highs and the biggest waves, and you know, you have that, you know, massive image. How do you navigate these sort of later years of your life in that, you know, in a peaceful contentment?
Well, it's not easy. You know, I think what's hard is that you look at the future of, you know, Mick and Joel changing. No disrespect to those guys in the industry and how it grew and the money everyone was making, and like, we were just right at the back end of it, you know, and you kind of, you know, some of us from my career, you know, have done well for themselves, and there's a few that haven't. I think that's hard, you know, sometimes in life. But I've always taken life as, you know, there's debt, right? And that's around us all the time. But I always look at my family that are healthy and my friends that have always been positive around me. And I've been very lucky like that. But it's not easy. It's not easy to be, you know, traveling the world like a rock star and then 2 years later that you just kind of slip into the bushes, you know. And, you know, we were unlucky in our generation too. I think that we didn't have social media. Like, if we would have had social media back then, well, we would have been in a lot of trouble for sure. But you know what? It might have changed. It might have changed things. You know, it might have changed our way of looking at competing and being professional. I'm not saying that we weren't professional, but we just, you know, we liked to have fun and there was no rules. And you know, when we put the singlet on, we're competing and we trained and we did all that. But, you know, we partied as well. But I think having social media back then would have made our, you know, Instagram accounts and all that look a lot bigger than what they actually are now.
You'd certainly be a lot wealthier than you are now, mate.
Yeah. And so I think out of all of it, that's the hardest thing. What's the hardest thing for me is to get my head around. But you know what? Like I said, I've been through a lot of ups and downs, you know. I can't even count how many. I've been really, really lucky that I've been able to just pull myself up and get myself going. And in saying that, the way that I found myself around that is really having a vision for something and training. It's always been, even through, right through Europe and stuff, I always did my own little training and stuff. And especially the 3 years that I finished second in the world and for the World Masters. But, yeah, and you know what? Life's not easy and it's not getting any easier. You know, and that's the other thing that I think I look at, and it's probably affected some other people of my generation, is that, you know, life's just kicking you in the guts right now. I mean, you look at the Australian economy, you look what we've been through with COVID, you look like, you know, you go to the supermarket, you spend $100 and you get 2 apples, you know, like it's and it's getting harder and harder, especially in this country, in Australia.
And you fill your tank of your car up and it's $150.
It might cost $200.
Jesus, what are you driving?
I got a car. I got a really good car.
Yeah.
I bought it off Nick from Mount Woodsy because I only get my cars off Nick. This one I got for $100. It's lasted 12 years. It's an XD Falcon station wagon. It's a classic.
What's that, 84 or something?
It's an answer 2002.
Okay.
And, yeah, I do all the oil changes myself and brake pads and stuff, and she goes like a rocket.
Well, $100 is a good deal.
Yeah, it's all right, eh? I've never been a big fan of cars. Motorbikes I have, but not cars, yeah.
Yeah. So we were talking before just about the, how hard it is to find that contentment in your later years. And it's been a wildly tragic last few years. I mean, you know, Sonny's in a, you know, vegetative state in Texas, and Derek's dead and Shmoo's dead. How do you react to those, you know, horrible events?
I was with Sonny and Derek at the last Masters at the Azores, and listen, you know, I know Sonny was fighting depression for a long time, and you know, he's pretty unstable, Sonny. Derek Shamu, you just don't really know what happened, you know. But something clicked in their life, obviously, that kind of left them feeling empty, I guess, that they had felt like they had nothing. You know, and geez, they had a lot. more to give, you know, in life. Again, I think there was no support net for us, you know. And I'm really upset about those three, you know, taking their lives, but there's no support from the association that we gave our lives to, you know. I think there's a real issue there. They trash you really, and you're off tour, and that's it. And there's no support net, you know. Like, you know, there's no support net for Andy either, right?
Yeah.
You know, I've always said if they had proper drug testing on the world tour, things would look a lot different than what they do now today.
Fuck, there wouldn't be anyone left on it from back in the 90s, anyway.
Well, yeah, and I don't think, I'm not talking about recreational drugs with Andy, I'm talking about heavy prescription drugs.
Yeah,
and different kinds of stuff. But yeah, listen, those three especially, I mean, I was close to Shamu, Derek, and especially Sonny. And yeah, mate, I guess some people just, you know, we don't know why. I've never had those thoughts, thank God. And like I said, I've got really good people around me that care about me and are always checking on me. So, yeah, that was a tough one to swallow, man. Like, you know, I lost my dad at the same time. It was just like, that was a whole, yeah, gnarly year for me, that's for sure.
And you were really close to Bully, huh?
To who's that, sorry?
To your dad, Bully.
Yeah, Dad was the Bull, geez. He outlived himself, that's for sure, but it was quite funny. Christmas morning, I just, he was in Grafton, palliative care, that's where his sisters are, and I had a feeling about Christmas morning when I was stuck. I'm going to see the old man, you know, let's jump in the car, look down. And got the call when I was pulling the graft and that he had a turn and he had a few. And, that night he died at 11 p.m.
Jesus. And you were there?
No, I just left. Wow. Yeah. Hung with him right till his end, just about, so. You know, and then Sonny and then Derek and Shamu and, you know, and then, God, and just, you are asking yourself questions, you know, like, what the fuck's going on here, you know? But again, the older we get, it seems like the more people that start to pass away, sadly, you know? It's life.
Yeah, it is life. I mean, you know, the passing of life is something that becomes, you know, incredibly into relief as you get older, like more and more people die, but it is because of getting older, and that's what happens to all of us. There's no way out.
Yeah, there's been a lot of people this year. I mean, you know, I knew Warnie a bit. That was a hard one to take. And
fuck, he died with his boots on though, huh?
He died with his boots on.
Fucking three hookers and a whatever else in a fancy villa in Thailand.
Well, I don't know those full reports, but I hope he did.
Yeah.
It's what a great way to go out.
Yeah, it's so good. classic Warnie, huh?
Yeah. But, you know, for the surfing world, yeah, I don't know. I don't even know if the association even sort of thought about that. You know what I mean? Like, what's going to happen to these guys like when they're off tour? Like, what? Does any sport look at that now? Do they? Or they don't because they make that much money and they've all got three houses and their cars and, you know.
Yeah, I think, I mean, now there's a pension plan, but I guess ironically, it's like you said, you know, most guys will retire with a roof over their head and a little bit of money in the bank. And if you've done well, you'll have, you know, 10 houses and
yeah,
a bunch of cars.
And that's good. And that's great. I'm stoked the way the sport's gone. Like, that's fantastic. It's just, you know, in generation talks, when you look at guys like Rabbit who are making even less, you know, sometimes I wonder what they think. But life is just really, it's just a lot harder now, you know. It's not the same cash flow. You know, you look at prices going up around the world, housing prices, the whole COVID thing, it's affected so many people, you know, and you look at the floods that we've had, you know, on the east coast of Australia. I mean, so many people's lives have been affected the last few years in different ways, and you know, we don't hear all the bad results of what's happened to them as well, you know. We just hear a few things that happen, not everything. So, yeah.
So what's
I just wish. Yeah.
There you go. You go, mate.
I just wish. I don't know why. Like with Derek and Shmoo and Sonny, you know, they've got so many people around. I just don't know why that could have happened. I don't. That's what I find it hard to understand. You know, they're people that are surrounded by good people. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, I know that if I was in that position, I'd be putting my mates that are here, I'd be putting my hand up straight away and going, hey, guys, you know. My really best mate, he's been fighting the Black Dog for a while, for many years. And I'd put my hand up straight away. You know what I mean? No matter what.
But you've always been a pretty optimistic kind of cat, though, huh?
Yeah, you know, if I really weigh up my year, I had a, you know, like, I just, you know, my dad and Sonny and Derek and Shmoo, I just had an 8-year relationship finish really badly. And then all this going on with the overweight stuff and the hip and stuff, I've had a really, really full-on year. But I'm always looking at the positives. I don't like living. I'm learning about this stuff of, like, you know, you live in the past, you're kind of living in depression. You live in the future, you've got anxiety, you know what I mean? What's coming up? You're living in the present, you can control the present. You know, you can visualize where you're at day by day and what you're doing. It's kind of how I look now. I do plan ahead with good things, and I do have some really good things coming up with Mount Woodgie and some great stuff going to happen with Bede, Mount Woodgie and stuff that's in the pipeline.
What are you doing? You doing Kong surfboards or something?
Mate, they've been selling Kong surfboards for about 30 years now.
Right, okay.
No, there's a lot of good stuff happening with Mount Woodgie that regarding the factory and stuff. I can't get into the detail, but there's probably soon I'll be moving down the Gold Coast, I believe. But that's going to kind of kick in again at the end of the year. So I've always been someone that's been lucky to, you know, I've been on a lot of, you know, drugs and stuff back in the day, and being able to get back and pull myself out and get back on the right, straight and narrow, you know. Some people don't have that. Some people look really, really tough and really strong and really thin like Sonny, and you know what I mean? And but inside there's a spot there that's not right, you know, and it's not just in surfing. I think it's in a lot of sports. We need to look at it more closely, you know. And we need people to understand that there's help, you know, there's help there. You know. Those three guys had, you know, look at the futures of those guys, you know, if they got help, you know.
Well, Derek was different, huh? Derek had a heart attack or something.
Yeah, I think, you know, that according to a lot of other stuff that he was doing as well, you know. But Derek wasn't well either.
Yeah.
That was
a sad one, because that was really out of the blue, and he'd been at Pipe and surfing amazing and doing videos with Mason.
Yeah. yeah, he wasn't looking well though, you know. There's a, I won't go into that one, but.
There's, yeah, it's very sad.
It's, yeah, you know, and it just hits close to home, you know, and, you know, like I said, I'm young, I'm 58 this year, and yeah, God, I've had some, I think the hardest year of my life I've had has been this year, and the start of last year with, you know, starting my dad and all that, and moving right through to, you know, my partnership I had with a person for like 8 years. I was really, really close. That just, yeah, ended in a really, really bad way. Not on my side, but, and that's taken a toll, because then I sit here on my own going, I'm kind of helpless with all this happening. But again, what I say to like people like that, you've always got to look at the positive stuff. And I used to do something on tour that I didn't tell anyone about, but I knew I was very fortunate on tour, even though I probably acted like a rat bag and a dickhead most of the time. But I would go to, everywhere I'd go to the local hospital and go to the children's ward and give out stickers and posters to all the sick kids, because what it did, that it actually brought me back to realise that how fortunate I was. And I think that's the thing I still look at sometimes, and I say to friends, I go, well, you know, and they're whinging about, you know, it's raining, or it's, you know, it's too hot or whatever. It's like, you know, go for a walk down the children's ward, you know, go see the parents that are going to have their kids in hospital like 24/7, they don't have a life. You know, we're still able to do stuff and to get around, and in that situation, you're blessed.
Oh, we're, you know, very, very lucky. Every day above ground's a good day, man.
Yeah, no, and that's how I look at it. I just go, you know, like, I think of kids that are handicapped. I think of, you know, my daughter's like super healthy and just charging, and the mum is, and you know, and myself, you know, I went, God, I had to do a bloody stress test heart thing where they pumped fluid into me 2 days ago, right? And I'm going, my dad's had quadruple bypasses, had stints put in the bypasses. You know, like, I'm just a classic candidate for it. I don't smoke anymore. I got smoking like 6 years ago. It's great. And I was waiting for the test to come back. I got it yesterday and they went, the pipes are perfectly clean, mate. There's nothing in there. I went, bullshit. They went, no, you're clean, you're good. And I went, holy shit. And that just gave me a, you know, even if it didn't, but, you know, just little, there's little things in life that you've got to just pick and put it in your pocket and make yourself feel good, you know. And, you know, I look around my room right now and I look at all my accomplishments that are on the wall and stuff, and I'm stoked. Maybe I didn't get the 3 world titles that I really wanted, but I know around 85 to 90 that I was probably doing the best surfing on the planet, and that's what really matters inside my heart.
So the next few years are looking pretty good, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Even hobbling around now in pain, next year's looking good. Next year's looking really good, and another big change in my life. I've had so many changes from growing up on the prawn trawler, from the world tour, living in France for 27 years, teaching kids to swim, being a carpenter and building Mount Widgie factory, all that Mount Widgie stuff. I built that for my mate, the whole lot, gutted the whole interior, polished every single thing that was done in there. I had my hands on that factory. To, you know, going down a one-way path again and just not caring about myself and going to 140 thing, then turn around again and come back out of that hole, which I did. And now just first really major surgery, and everything's looking good for that. So, yeah, fingers crossed. And 1st of January, I'll be back in the water on my 6'4" and not my 8-footer.
Can't wait to see you shredding again, man.
I'm pumped, yeah.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.